whole thing is that the issue, we'll just bring people in. They can talk about things that are important to them, and they won't have to plug their current movie or any of that kind of stuff. And we'll just have a conversation. So all you have to do is show up. Well, and somebody says, all you have to do is show up.
Yeah.
Which, as we all know, is the most difficult part of making movies. It's showing up. If you don't show up, you can't do anything. But once you show up, so I show up for these podcasts, and by golly, it's been a lot of fun.
Of course, we make the guests do all the work. So you were up all night just cramming for this, and we were, I was watching screeners. I don't know about
a very small setup. How do you do that? Is it nanobots?
It's digital, Joseph. It's ones and zeros.
In the old days, you used to have to go into a big studio and, lots of baffles.
I guess the difference in the old days is if a tape melted, you could pretty much splice it together and just lose a 30 seconds. Now, if something goes wrong with the zeros and ones, all of it just disappears in space. This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Yeah, well, this is actually our first of
our first show
of the 20s, the first show of our third season of The Movies That Made Me. We've had some great guests, but I don't think Joe or I would we be here? Would we be such giants in our industry that we could be hosting a podcast like this had we not first gotten into the film industry? I would not be in the film industry if it weren't for Roger Corman. I really wouldn't. You had such an impact on an era of film that was the era I grew up on, that I've talked a lot about my father taking me off to see all these wildly inappropriate movies from, these filmmakers that you gave their first shots to. And we're here with Julie as well, who's the two of you.
It's a little slice of Hollywood history. All
it really
up in two
is.
People.
I'm trying to think about what I would be doing if you guys had decided to go into another line of work. I have no idea.
Well, there's a lot of people in Hollywood who've been doing something different.
There would, and imagine what movies would be. But it is such an honor to I want to say have you here. But we have come to you. We're in your offices. I'll try to focus entirely on you and not look at all the amazing stuff here. Although I will ask you, even though we don't do interviews, I want to ask you at one point about The Intruder. I have a question, but, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, I don't think we'd be here today if it hadn't been Joe Dante's showing up in the trailer department and going on to fame and glory.
I owe it all to Caged Heat.
That's right. but anyway, thank you for coming on. This is a real honor, Julie, Roger.
Well, be happy to sort of roam around with these various films that had some meaning to us at some time. Maybe still having meaning.
Well, wonderful. Yeah, that was kind of the thing. We were like, whatever you guys want to discuss. So,
well, when obviously film going, when you were younger in the 30s, I guess it would be. What was the average trip to the movies like? Did you go with your family? Did you go on your own? Did you go to double bills? You were in Connecticut?
I was born in Detroit, but moved to California when I was very young. And there were two ways to go to the movies, sometimes with my parents, and generally on Saturday afternoons, my friends and I would go to see the matinees on Saturday. I remember one of the first films I saw, I walked out on, was Mutiny on the Bounty.
Murdering butcher. I've had enough of this bloodship. He's the master of life and death on the quarterdeck above the angels. McCoy! Quill! I'm sick of blood. Bloody backs, bloody faces. Why are you doing your last command on this ship? We'll be men again if we hang for it.
Casting me adrift, 3,500 miles from a port of call, you're sending me to my doom, eh? Well, yes! this in. I'll take these Baltashi floats to England if I must. I'll live to see you, all of you, hanging from the highest yardarm in the British fleet.
I thought it was a great film until Clark Gable got whipped, and I saw the blood and the whipping, and I just got up and walked out of the theater.
Oh my! Because it was too graphic?
It was too graphic.
He's a sensitive child.
Yes, yes. Well, that shows up in his work.
Maybe my work is a reaction that to Mutiny on the Bounty.
That could be. That's amazing. And how about you, Julie? What was your sort of experience growing up going to movies?
Well, I grew up in St. Louis and went, you know, till I was older with my parents. And in sort of thinking back about films that were significant for me, I am trying to figure out what my parents had in mind, because my favorite childhood movie was Francis the Talking Mule.
Yes, Francis is that kind of a picture, worthy of ranking with the greatest screen comedies of all time. At the preview, the audience laughed loud and long, and the comment cards made us blush with pride.
I love the insouciance of the mule, and Donald O'Connor is the sidekick in that case. But the same year they took me to see that, they also took me to see one of the most terrifying films that today I have nightmares getting in an elevator, and that was The Day the Earth Stood Still.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Drew Pearson. We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon, the arrival of a spaceship in Washington. The Army has taken every precaution to meet any emergency which may develop. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
But the one that really gave me nightmares, the year before, Samson and Delilah, and another of my childhood favorites, Ma and Pa Kettle. Now, that juxtaposition was, to this day, nightmares thinking about Victor Mature bringing down the temple and the pillars and...
On Marjorie Main's head.
Now, relive the colossal drama of the mightiest colossus that ever lived. Samson and Delilah, the immortal story of the strongest man in all history. A masterpiece of big screen entertainment.
This wasn't a double bill, was it?
No, I don't think so. But I'm just trying to think of what my parents had in mind. I didn't have the option to walk out of the theater, but really, in Samson and Delilah, I would have. I mean, The Day the Earth Stood Still, the elevator stopping comes, you know, too quickly to do anything about its impact. But so anyway, that was my childhood memories of the films that made me. And literally to this day, they affect my life.
Those films?
Yes. Can't get an elevator without thinking about The Day the Earth
really?
Stood Still.
Really?
No.
Wow.
Probably so many stairs here in the office.
Yeah, and that explains that. That's fascinating. I mean, I think also there was, you know, I noticed as a kid, which was a little bit later, but there were always kids' films. But I feel like, you know, the majority of content coming your way from Hollywood was not kids' films. So your parents would, every now and then, you know, there'd be a nod towards my existence and we'll go to a kids' movie. But mostly you went to essentially adult films with your parents. So, I mean, I think if you were growing up today, you'd probably see a lot more children's films.
But in the day, you know, an adult film was still probably suitable for a kid.
Right. That too. Yeah.
And today that's not the case at all.
Samson and Delilah, suitable for an 8-year-old.
Well,
you know, if you're afraid of getting your hair cut, I guess it's a pretty scary movie. I never had that reaction to any DeMille movies because I was usually pretty bored with them. I too saw the majority of my movies at Saturday matinees, and the bromide was that if you went to the Saturday matinee and you were the first boy or girl in line, you could get in for free at local theater in Livingston, New Jersey. Which meant that you could take the quarter that it would ordinarily take you to get in, and you could spend it on candy and popcorn and stuff, which was really cheap at the time. But if it was an adult movie, like the Solid Gold Cadillac, I remember being a movie that I just didn't understand anything that was going on in it. And I spent most of my time looking for more money on the floor of the theater so that I could buy more candy.
Or you could finance your first film.
The first
Roger
film
Corman,
I made, maybe so.
Staying in character.
Well, actually, the first film that I remember that really impressed me was an English science fiction film I saw in the 30s called Things to Come.
We live in interesting, exciting, and anxious times.
Don't be too sure of progress.
Well, what's going to stop progress nowadays?
War. There is war and rumor of war.
The unknown aircraft passed over Sea Beach and dropped bombs.
I was very much interested in science. I had a chemistry set, and I was building model airplanes so forth. And I had never seen a picture like this before. It was the first science fiction picture I ever saw.
Wow.
And it correctly predicted, being made in the 30s, that there was going to be a Second World War.
Mm.
But it showed the Second World War, but then said the war spread around the entire world and destroyed civilization, and civilization fell into dictatorial barbarism. And at the worst moment of this barbarism, a super futuristic airplane landed, and a very distinguished man came out, and he said he represented a community of scientists who had separated themselves from the rest of the world and were now prepared to take over and create a rational, scientific-based society. The dictator, of course, objected. There was a big battle. The scientists won. And then you saw what appeared to be the perfect society, totally rational, all based on science, and ending with man's first attempt to put a man in space. And I was just blown away by the film. I thought, this is just brilliant. And I still remember it,
yeah.
As with all today's science fiction, with computer graphics and everything, with the limited effects they had at that time, that film still shows up.
Yeah, no, it's a great film.
And there's some great stuff in it. I mean, the montages at the beginning about the beginning of World War II, and it was directed by William Cameron Menzies, who was a great... was actually the first production designer, the first person to actually get that title. He did Dawn of the Wind, and you know, he did a science fiction picture later called Invaders from Mars, which he did on $1.98, but has a real dreamlike quality to it that has scared many generations of children. But you know, Things to Come was written by H.G. Wells from his own book.
Yes.
And seen today, it is a little windy. It's a little polemical. There's a lot of speechifying by Ralph Richardson and Raymond Massey, but even so, I mean, it's still a pretty remarkable movie, and it is unfortunately not really very well known today. It's not very often revived.
I feel like it pops up every now and then. I'm trying to remember if there's an HD version of it floating around somewhere that I saw a few years ago, but yeah, it sort of. Doesn't get the love that a lot of films from a few years later do. But I'm always interested because I remember as a kid going to movies that I look at now, you know, and because of all the evolution of effects and so forth, you go back and you go, oh, that looks ridiculous. But you believed it then.
Yes.
And you were not sitting there going, these are miniatures. Or
Well, you wanted to believe it. That was
yeah,
the whole thing
yeah.
about going to the movies was that you wanted to believe that there was really a giant spider going down the street. You
yeah.
weren't looking for matte lines. You weren't right. looking for places where you could see through it or any of the other mistakes that could have been made. It's because you wanted to believe it because that was the appeal of
yeah.
going to the movies, was creating another world for yourself.
Well, I almost feel now when things are hyper real and there's some, you know, and the effects aren't quite working, it's somehow more noticeable than if you're just buying into an artifice, which we were doing, you know, as children in those old films. But now everything's sort of photographic, so you actually feel like if this thing doesn't look like it weighs as much as it should, it kind of throws me out of the movie. You know, I love old effects.
Well, Roger, you know, when you finally started making films in the early 50s and got involved with doing science fiction because it was a genre that you could double bill pictures in. Drive-ins and horror films were popular, and obviously they were all aimed at a younger audience. Obviously the challenges were, how do you create a believable spaceship out of nothing, you know, and how do you make it look like it's really flying around in space? And when you look back on some of these movies, it's obvious that the computer is made up of film reels and that the chairs are actually Barco loungers. But nonetheless, the movies themselves have a certain conviction and a certain purity that makes them still work to me. I mean, I think some of the more financially challenged movies of that period are among the best, because in order to make up for that, you have to have characters, you have to have plot, you have to have dialogue, and you have to have an attitude. And so, you know, when a picture like War of the Satellites comes on, which has minimal effects by our beloved Jack Raven, who was very nice to me as I was growing up, it still works for me.
Well, War of the Satellites was an example of how we worked at that time. I had seen on television one night the first Russian Sputnik going up. The next morning at 9 o'clock, I was in Steve Broidy's office, who was the head of Allied Artists. And I said, "Steve, if you can give me $75,000, I will have a satellite picture ready to be in the theaters, finished, answer print, everything, in 90 days. And he said, "Done." Oh, he first said, "What is your story?" I said, "I don't have a story." He said, "That's okay. I'll give you the $75,000. Wow. That's the way we used to function. We just say, I'd say, "Here's the idea." He said, "I'll give you the money," either he or Arkoff or Nicholson, and Nicholson at AIP. Today, you spend the first 90 days drawing up the contract.
Right, right. I'll cut this if it's not okay. Do you want to talk for a minute about what you were working on when we got here? Because it connects to that so beautifully. Or is that a secret?
Actually, what I'm working on is just what you said. It's the thought of going back to the way I started, because I'm working on a couple of projects that are going to take a little while to develop. And I've got nothing really happening at the moment. A siren keeps going by. We may be in the midst of some catastrophe here.
Should we start filming it in case the...
But I was invited to the Nassau Film Festival in September, and the festival was postponed because of the hurricane and pushed back to December. Meanwhile, I saw some drone footage of the devastation, and it was far greater than anything I dreamed of. So I thought, I'd like to go back and see if as an old man I can do what I did as a young man, move immediately and make a picture. I bought the drone footage, hired the cameraman to go back and shoot footage on the ground, then going to the festival, scouted the locations, and immediately after this discussion, I'm meeting with a writer, and we hope to be shooting in about a month and a half on a picture tentatively called Crime City, laid in a devastated island in the tropics.
Brilliant, brilliant. And that movie will probably be out before this episode drops. I still have to edit it, so that's fantastic. Wow.
I didn't know you built your office in such a high crime area.
Yeah.
Well, it keeps you awake.
It's not going on right outside the window, whatever it is, but I'll start shooting if it does. Julie, do you want to go to another film on your...
On my list?
Yes.
Well, you know, the 60s were really about social awareness for my generation, who kind of grew up with the 50s mentality of, you know, trying to make everything normal after the Depression and the war. So the films that you know, were sort of part of my becoming very aware of these were Rogers the Intruder.
This man, take a good look at him. He's a specialist. He knows exactly how to turn this quiet town
into a hell of violence.
The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. They are willing to fight down to the last ditch and keep fighting till this thing is over.
I didn't know about The Intruder. I didn't know Roger when he made The Intruder. And by the time I knew Roger, he was making The Wild Angels and The Trip. And there was really no time to go back because he was in such a furious, single-minded progress forward. I don't remember where I saw it, but I've seen it more than once. And it was particularly significant to me because it was shot in the state where I grew up, which was Missouri, which was a slave state. St. Louis is on the Mason-Dixon line. And although Roger shot in the Boot Heel near Arkansas, it was this kind of mentality about blacks, which was submerged, but very prevalent. I mean, blacks couldn't go to the Howard Johnsons. They couldn't go to the hotels. They sat in the back of the church. And so to take that, as Chuck Beaumont did in The Intruder, to its logical extension, with some brilliant acting by real and non-real actors, I was just riveted by it and, you know, was very impressed by it. And at the same time, I was seeing films like the one that still gives me nightmares also when I think about it, because it divorced me from reality, was Women in the Dunes. Mm-hmm. So I had been an English major, so I was very sort of conscious of the myth of Sisyphus as it pertained to it. The idea of the woman being trapped and the man being trapped with her, and what the task is, which eventually leads to this kind of existential, not even a crisis, but attitude of it's never ending, it will go on because that's the way it is. And then Kobo Abe's work continued to go that way about people trapped in situations. So another film, another book he wrote that was made into film was The Box Man, but I think Women in the Dunes is the one. And I think it gives Lawrence of Arabia a run for its money in the treatment of sand. So that, for kind of the other one of that era that I saw that was made earlier was E. Vitaloni and the after the war and the neorealism, this idea of the young men being trapped and which direction are they going to go. And then, you know, that scene at the end with the train is just like, but where are they going? Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe kind of a motto for my generation.
Sure. Yeah. Well, for all of us these days, I think, sadly. Mm-hmm. I should know this. Again, I say we do no research, but when did you and Roger meet?
1964.
Oh, okay. So you knew him by this point, and you were
by the time
you see The Intruder.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, okay. No, I did.
And where did you meet him?
Job interview.
Oh, wow.
A job interview that I understand you didn't get.
Well, she actually turned.
Yeah, that would be your interpretation.
I would say that she turned down the job, but she agreed to have dinner with me.
So. Oh, wow. Really? So you turned it down.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I couldn't understand what the job was. So I had, if somebody asked me what, being Roger's assistant was today, I still couldn't describe it. But I had, three job interviews, and one was Roger, and one was the advertising agency and a training program, they called it, and one was at the LA Times. And so I went to work at the advertising agency. I thought it'd be more fun, and it was.
Oh, than working for Roger?
No, than going to the LA Times.
Oh, okay, yes. It all comes out.
Yeah. So actually, when I did work with Roger, I stopped in Ireland because my family was Irish. This is now, by now, 1970, and I was on my way to Paris, but I stopped in Ireland because my family was Irish and Roger was about to shoot Von Richthofen and Brown. And then in Roger's own inimitable way, he said, "My brother's in England working on the insurance and the production manager hasn't arrived. I wonder if you could just help me out for a couple of days." So anyway.
And those days are continuing to this day.
That's right. Just kept walking along together.
Roger, as long as we're talking about The Intruder, I said I wanted to ask. I have a good friend who's going to be on our show shortly, Blake Masters. He's a great TV writer. And he actually wrote a paper in college on The Intruder. But one of his sort of questions is, because it is famously kind of the only movie you ever made that didn't make money, correct?
At that time. In 1960, it got wonderful reviews.
Yeah, it's a great
best
film.
Reviews I ever had.
Yep.
And the first film I ever made that lost money. However, in around 2000, Bill Shatner was his first film, who played the lead, and I did a commentary for a DVD. And 40 years after the film came out, we finally got our money back off the DVD.
Fantastic. Okay, so your record's spotless now, is it?
More or less.
But no, Blake. But I thought it was an interesting question. What do you think the impact would have been on your career if the film had been a success at the time?
I probably would have changed and done more contemporary films. As such, I did go back a little bit with The Wild Angels and The right. Trip, but I moved on, and I felt that maybe I was too serious with The Intruder. Despite the more or less acclaim it got, I felt I may have bored the audience. I was giving them a lecture rather than making a motion picture. Mm. So I determined that the way, if I wanted to make a statement, it should be more or less a subtext. The picture should be an entertainment, and first and foremost, it should entertain the audience. And subtextually, if the audience wanted to pick up on any theme or anything I wanted, that was fine, but that was a bonus. And that was more or less the way I worked since right. then.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, no, I think brainwashing is always more effective than lecturing, I guess. But it's a wonderful film, and it must be. Joe, you're the... How long is it? About 82 minutes?
That's 82 minutes.
Yeah, that is not
that
a film
back
that
when,
slows
down. That was
down
back when movies didn't all run 2.5 hours
yes.
like they do this year.
Yeah, yeah. No, that is a fast-paced film. I never felt for a minute like I was being lectured by it. It's well, if people haven't seen it, please seek it out.
It has a lot of science fiction authors in the movie. I mean, Chuck Beaumont, who wrote the script, right. is in the movie playing a teacher. What's his name? I always forget. He's just passed away. He plays a redneck. Charles. God, I've got his name.
It'll hit
have
you
to
in
cut
20
this
minutes.
Piece out.
Yes.
Sorry.
But a fantastic film. Hey, dude, do you want to hit us up with your next one or two? Or?
Well, I'm going back to the 30s. I wouldn't say there was one film, but there were a number of gangster films. Mm. Public Enemy, Little Caesar. Prohibition had just taken place. The gangsters were fading out as a result, but they were still somewhat contemporary. And this was the time of the Depression, of rebellion against society. And I think I and many people identified with the gangsters. We right. knew the gangsters were going to lose in the end.
Right.
We knew that had to be. But at the same time, we went along for the ride right. until the ending. So I like those pictures in particular.
Were you, you knew they were going to lose in the end.
Yeah.
Were you wise to the fact that that was a Hollywood rule, or did it give you the sense that this was a dead end lifestyle, that you thought it was realistic?
We knew it was a Hollywood rule. Good. We didn't know about the Hayes. We didn't
right,
know
right.
what the rules were, but we knew that was sort of the rules of the game.
Right.
And
right.
we knew that.
So
and also
still...
the corporatization of crime, when which is a subtext in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which you made in 1967.
Yes.
One of the things about the mob and it was corporatized, and all during particularly in the 50s, there were lots of movies about how the mob was being run by a corporation.
Yeah.
And now we have a government that's being run like a corporation. It's quite similar.
Yeah. Unlike that corporation.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I remember as a kid seeing Angels with Dirty Faces on TV.
Oh, yes.
And just, I don't know. We hate to spoil the ending, so I won't. But the ending of that movie at, you know, 8 or 9 was, I think, my first introduction to this layers of complexity that, you know, is he breaking down and begging for mercy? Is he doing it for the kid? It's just, it's such a powerful ending. I've seen 100, you know, thousands of films more recently made. I don't remember a thing about, but the ending of that film stays with me all the time. So,
well, it was interesting. I never thought of this before, but actually the heyday of the gangster films were the early 30s. But by the end of the 30s, you suddenly had Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade, and you had the Private Eye, who were against the gangsters.
Right.
So we were coming out of the Depression. Times were changing, and I think films or any art form reflect to a large extent the culture of the day.
Sure.
So when you were watching these films, was there any inkling in the back of your mind that this might be something you might want to do?
No. Not really. It never occurred to me to pick up a machine gun and shoot up a
plane. No.
I mean, make a movie.
Well, I wasn't thinking. My father was an engineer, and I was planning on being an engineer. But that would bring me to probably the next film that had some significance to me. I was writing for the Stanford Daily, and I found out that the film critics for the Daily got free passes to all the theaters in Palo Alto. So I thought, well, I'd like to see movies for nothing. And
sure.
I wrote a sample review, and they took me on. And I remember the first official review I wrote was on Western, My Darling Clementine.
Shave, please.
Well, we sure want to thank you, Mr. Earp.
Wyatt Earp.
What? You're not by any chance the marshal from Dodge City.
Ex-marshal. What are you doing up here?
None of your business.
Why don't you behave yourself? Go on, get out. Go on back where you
I'm
belong.
I'm not leaving till she gets out of town.
The first kiss is always the sweetest. From under a broad sombrero.
Told you to get out of town and stay out. We're through talking, Marshal. My advice to you is start carrying your gun.
That's good advice.
Here's mighty entertainment that combines the exciting action of reckless pioneer days, the romantic conflicts of men and women who led perilous lives, the lusty humor of those who dared America's frontiers, and the breathtaking beauty of scenes filmed in the magnificence of the great Southwest.
In retrospect, really one of the great Westerns.
Yes.
And I remember being struck particularly, now I was looking at the film, I had to analyze it, and I started to get into it, and the structure of the film with Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, before the gunfight at the Oak Creek Canal, Corral, but also the photography, John Ford and his cinematographer, we used to say his cameraman, but now we say cinematographer or director of photography,
DP, yes.
Or dictator of whatever. I thought the photography was so stark, so beautiful in two ways. Every shot was perfectly composed, and the lighting had tonality of dark against light. And I began to appreciate the sheer beauty of a black and white film, as well as the drama of the story. I gave it a very good review. Some of my later reviews weren't so good, but that one I liked.
What a great way to start. Oh, my God.
That was back when there were movies that good to review.
Wow. Every now and then, we squeak one out, I think. That's fantastic. I also, you know, it occurred to me when you were talking about the gangster movie segueing into Private Eyes, it was also a lot of them are the same actors.
Yes.
I think of Bogart, who was always a gangster and then becoming, so it was just a kind of seamless transition from one side of the law to the other.
Yes. He became both Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And all those gangsters were a little bit good and all those detectives were a little bit bad.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Actually, I was told by a casting director somewhere along the line that when they were casting cops and robbers, they picked the same guys
for either side.
For either side.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Julie, what do you got for us next? Where are we going? Are we still in the 60s, or are we?
Well, yeah, I think we have to stay with the 60s before we get to the 70s. So the 60s. So I think for my high school, the book that was, you know, what we were about was Catcher in the Rye. And then from
which
college.
Which has eluded ever being made into a movie because Salinger wouldn't let it happen.
I know that.
Because apparently they made a picture out of Uncle Wiggily Goes to Connecticut.
Right.
It was a sort of a, and they gave it a sort of a sappy title. And it was a romance and he hated it. And because he hated it, he said, okay, no more.
No.
And so no one has ever made a movie out of Catcher in the Rye, which I'm sure
people have
beaten down the door trying to get the rights to do it.
Including his son. But anyway, I think then after my college experience that there's kind of a through line from Catcher in the Rye to The Graduate. Talk with you again.
Listen, everybody, I want you all to be quiet. I've got Ben's college yearbook here, and I just want to read you some of the wonderful things about Ben.
Hey, there's the award-winning scholar.
We're all very proud of you, Ben.
How are you, track star?
What are you going to do now?
I was going to go upstairs for a minute.
Oh, I meant with your future. Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
Because a vision softly creeping.
So I remember standing in line to see The Graduate, and it was, if Catcher in the Rye was about everybody's a phony, then, you know, The Graduate, plastics. But it did sort of speak to my time. And the satire of Mike Nichols, I don't know, I really liked it.
Yeah, that's an amazing film. I mean, and it's one that I still, you know, I watch it every few years, and I'll try to show it to someone who hasn't seen it. And this isn't necessarily something a film has to strive for, but it always feels like it was made yesterday.
The ending felt very different in 1967 than when I last saw it, was maybe really 5 years ago, and that when that very enigmatic look on Dustin Hoffman's face.
Well, because now you know
exactly
where they're going.
Right. So
How did that play to you the first time you saw it, do you think? Do you remember?
I just like was caught up in the exuberance of it and like, yes, that's right. And he's sitting in the room listening to Sounds of Silence, and, you know, Mrs. Robinson is like, you know, I mean, I couldn't have thought it. And Bancroft is unbelievable. And
for sure. But I mean, that last shot.
Yeah.
The
last shot?
Yeah.
I don't think I got, I don't remember getting quite that take on it of really understanding where they were going as I did later.
Yeah.
As many films that I see later or books that I read later, I like identifying with the older person or looking at it from a different viewpoint, certainly. But the other movie, I must confess, and there may be some groans across the table here.
Oh, good. You like
it. Really? Well, while Roger was enamored of Lawrence of Arabia, I was totally swept away by The Sound of Music.
The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for a thousand years.
As I sound your signals, you will step forward and give your names. You, Fraulein, will listen carefully, learn their signals so you can call them when you want them.
The celebrated play that delighted the world. Actually photographed amidst the wondrous beauties of Salzburg, Austria. With Julie Andrews, Academy Award winner for Best Actress of the Year in Walt Disney's Mary Poppins. Now in the new and glorious role of Maria.
How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you catch a cloud and pin it down?
Totally swept away. I mean, if anything caught, you know, my romantic nature as a teenage girl, Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, The King and I, Carousel, Oklahoma. You know, and my friend's parents used to go to New York and come back with the, you know, with the record albums. And we'd play them and pretend to be all the people. And oh, my God. And so that was it, The Sound of Music. Just had a wonderful time. That's all I can say.
Is Joe suppressing a groan?
No, I'm not. Okay.
Said across the table.
It's across the table.
Roger. Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, Lawrence of Arabia, not so much. So.
No, but there's no women in it.
Yep. Well, that too. Anyway, Roger may have a comment on Lawrence of Arabia. Perhaps.
Well, one of the great things about Lawrence of Arabia, there were no new musical numbers.
So you're speaking to my heart, Roger. But do you have, are you, I don't like musicals. That said, do you have this? There are a few that I love. Do you have any that you...
I will come to one, and as a matter of fact, I'll tell,
oh,
you,
it's on your
tell
list?
You right now, because In general, I don't like musicals. But there was one musical, My Fair Lady. When I saw it, I thought, this is the best musical I have ever seen. The story was, of course, from a George Bernard Shaw play, and the music was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Almost every song was a hit. And I thought, musicals have really reached a peak with My Fair Lady. How do you do better? And I'm not certain anybody has done any better since. To me, that was the peak of musicals.
I could have danced all night. Came Bill.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
On the street where you lived? I've said this on the show, so I can back it up. But yeah, that's my... my go-to for my exceptions. There are a few others, but My Fair Lady is just, why is that though? I mean, obviously the music's great. Yeah. Do you find, this is a terrible, I think I've said this, do I find over the years my perception of Henry Higgins changes? I've certainly had times when I thought.
Henry Higgins,
yeah.
I'd say, not exactly a me too, or is he?
What about I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair?
That's a nice song.
Come on.
But that's South Pacific. That's a pretty problematic movie.
Well,
but I remember, yeah, when we were talking, and when you mentioned the records, my mother, I grew up with the album of My Fair Lady. It had the great Hirschfeld drawing on the cover.
Oh.
Rex Harrison.
Yeah, I liked it too, but
not
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
That's funny. I wonder why there's something Freudian in there that someone could get to, I suppose. But I'd rather not look
Freudian
in
all
every. Yeah. I probably don't want to know why I like
Roger.
My
there's
Fair
something
Lady.
Freudian in everything. Just look at the movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you had mentioned Lawrence of Arabia. I was going to say two pictures that impressed me, and I think are two of the greatest pictures, Citizen Kane and Lawrence of Arabia. Mm-hmm. But Sight and Sound, a number of years ago, sent out questionnaires to directors all around the world to name their favorite film. And Citizen Kane and Lawrence of Arabia, for obvious reasons, were chosen by almost everybody. There was one film, however, I chose, which I'll come to as we come to the end of this. I want to hold to a climax.
Okay, yes,
there.
Yes.
Ever the Showman.
I was the only one who picked that film. They asked me to write an article about it because I was the only one who picked it. But I do believe Citizen Kane and Lawrence of Arabia, for the reasons everybody knows, are two of the great and significant films.
Now, do they, because I'm wondering how far our kinship on these things go with My Fair Lady. That's enough. But do you, I watch Citizen Kane all the time. It's never moved me. Does it, do you have an emotional reaction to it? Do you?
It did move me.
It did?
It moved me primarily for the arc, which is a current word.
Yes.
The arc of Kane's life. Mm-hmm. He starts as just a lucky little kid in Colorado whose family strikes some mineral and is going and goes from nothingness in Colorado to an elite boarding school, a trajectory to become so powerful. Mm-hmm. And then something within him causes him to be self-destructive, and you see the falling back to the end. And at the end, you go back to the very first scene in the picture. So I thought the structure of the film was beautifully laid out, as well as all of the actors were good.
Yeah.
Orson Welles was brilliant as Kane, but so were all the other actors. And the photography was very, very good. It was one of the first uses of very deep focus, which was a fact that the lenses were getting better, and you were able to, first you had a good cinematographer, and second you had better lenses to work with, so you had a more realistic picture, 2D, which began to look almost like 3D.
Right. But I'm wondering, but see, those are, it's interesting. Everything you're telling, were you, the first time you saw the film, were you feeling all that? What were you feeling?
I was. I identified with Cain, and I identified with his friend as well, because he had his own trajectory, because he came from wealth. He came from where Cain wanted to be, but never could quite fit in. He was never accepted the way his friend was.
Right. And Julie, your ambivalence about Lawrence, you said, how do you feel about Cain? Was that a...
Oh, no, it was a masterpiece of the film.
Okay, so he grabbed you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean...
I don't really see how you can not find that the ending of that movie emotionally.
Oh, no, no, the ending is effective. I don't know what it is, you know? I watch Touch of Evil over and over. I watch Touch of Evil for pleasure. And it's a rougher
but,
and rawer.
But Cain is a very funny movie. I mean, there's a lot of really funny stuff in it. And
I don't know what it is. I keep going back to it. You know, I go to learn from it. Whereas, you know.
Well, obviously you haven't learned very much.
Clearly, yes. Okay, fine. Let's rub that in. Julie, what's next? What have you?
Oh, on mine? Well, there was a kind of surprising thing that happened in our company, which is that Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers was up for grabs. And so Roger, having been a great fan of Ingmar Bergman's from early on, said to Paul Koner, I'll take it. And Paul said, no, you have to see it first. So we saw it, and it was just riveting. And I think, you know, looking at the films that have influenced me, obviously several of mine had to do with the plight of women. And in this case, I really couldn't get over, I kind of wondered how men reacted to it, although it was very successful. Roger distributed it and it did well. Because it was so insightful about the dark side of women's natures. And particularly being one of three girls, how these sisters interacted. But more importantly, that he rooted it in this woman who gave and didn't ask for anything in return. And none of the others was like that. And so that juxtaposition was what really grabbed me early on and carried me through the movie to the Pieta scene at the end. So I think to this day, when I think about that film, it's very emotional for me. The performances, those incredible women who had worked with Bergman for so long, and this was like, I don't know, for me, it's his best film. Mm. Yeah, very, very emotional.
Well, now it's interesting that Julie brought up Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers, because the next film I was going to mention was Bergman's The Seventh Seal, which I thought was a true masterpiece. We'd been accustomed to seeing knights in armor fighting in the Middle Ages in beautiful technicolor, and everything was clean and lovely and wonderful. And here was this black and white, down and dirty looking film. And I thought, that's the way I think it was in the Middle Ages. They weren't all beautiful and wonderful costumes. They were peasants. They were dirty villages. And I particularly liked, of course, the scene at the beginning, which most people still remember, where the knight plays chess with the devil for his soul. And I thought that was a really great opening scene. And then you follow through. Now, to me, the film was a true masterpiece. But in addition, because the scene of the knight playing chess with the devil, an American college student, as a student film, made a film.
Yeah,
of the knight playing badminton
with the
devil, and it was really funny.
Madeline Kahn.
And somebody sent it to Ingmar Bergman saying, as I understand, this is how somebody has really ruined your concept, but instead Bergman thought it was great.
Of course. Well, the thing people...
He supposedly had a great sense of humor. I mean, everybody thinks of him as Seven very Seals. Dour. But...
Seven Seals is a very funny movie. I remember as a kid being... It was just one of those things, you know, it felt like, you know, you got to eat your vegetables. You're going to have to see The Seventh Seal. I remember I finally saw it. But how come no one told me it's so funny? My uncle, who is not a huge film guy, first when I would go visit him in Essex, Massachusetts as a kid, they would every now and then have people over and he would, I guess he'd go to the library and he'd get a 16mm projector because I had a few 16mm films in the library. He would show people Der Duva.
Oh.
And I still remember being, you know, 10 or 11 years old and everybody turning pale when I asked them to explain because there's a scene. I remember it's all in pigeon or phony Swedish.
Phony Swedish, yeah.
And there's a scene where Madeleine Kahn offers somebody a cigar and says, would you like a phallic symbol? and asking people to explain what a phallic symbol was great fun. But that's interesting because he picks a sort of, you know, a more male-centric Bergman film. Of course, you go for...
Oh, well, that's true. But Roger being Roger and Bergman being Bergman... went another direction with Cries and Whispers. So I think Roger is best to tell you how it ended up on a double bill with Jonathan Demme's movie, Caged Heat.
Oh, wait, sorry, hang on.
Well, would you like me to repeat that?
Cries and Whispers and Caged Heat.
Caged Heat. Enter the female jungle of women's prison, USA. A seething hell of steel and stone where bodies behind bars ache with hunger for a man, any man. Where caged passions ignite in carnal confinement and explode into violence.
Caged Heat is
the combination you've been waiting for.
Yes, it's in a drive-in in Tennessee.
Oh, my.
Well, here's what happened.
That made money, but the intruder didn't.
Yeah, that made up for the intruder. But what happened, we opened it. The way you normally open an art film.
Uh-huh.
We open in key theaters, first in New York, and then Los Angeles, then other major cities, and then in college towns. And these were the major ways you showed such a film. Now, we did this all summer long, and come fall, our other films, the films we were making, played a lot of drive-ins. And I knew that in the fall, the drive-ins had trouble getting films because the major studios at that time had very little faith in them and didn't particularly, they only played them to a certain extent. And we knew the drive-in audience was diminishing because the weather was changing. And I thought, why don't I try Cries and Whispers in a drive-in? Why not? What have I got to lose? And we put it together with Jonathan Demme's first film, A Woman in Prison Picture, Caged Heat. And the picture did average business. And I think we were the only people ever delighted to do average business. And I actually got a letter from Bergman. I think
I
Julie
have the
is
letter
holding it. We
had that Roger has on his wall. Do you want to read it or do
Why
you want
don't
me
you
to?
Read it?
Ingmar Bergman, Faro. If I pronounce it correctly, Copenhagen, February 19th, 1973. Dear Mr. Corman, I am very pleased to tell you that my wife and I will be in Cannes from May 18th to 22nd so that I personally can tell you how grateful and satisfied I am for your excellent work with my picture. With warm personal regards, Ingmar Bergman. Yeah.
Did he know about the double feature? Or?
Yeah.
You know,
Ingmar Bergman movies didn't generally play drive-ins
in Tennessee. You know?
But one of the perks that was Roger was able to give to all these European directors was I can get you audiences that you've never had before,
right.
Because we can get your pictures played in places that don't ordinarily play them. And he became the go-to guy.
Yeah.
For foreign films, which used to be released by United Artists and companies like that, and they all ended up coming to Roger.
Well, I mean, isn't that the dream? Finally, is to show your movies to people who would normally not see them. I mean,
because they played the normal theaters that an art film would play,
right?
And then as a bonus, we put them in more commercial
theaters. That's lovely. How much did you have much dealings with him? Did you meet him and?
No, I did not meet him.
Wow.
I thought we met him in Cannes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes, I was thinking, yes, we met him in Cannes. Yeah. I was thinking in relationship to the distribution.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
actually, and you're right. He's considered to be a very dour, as
yeah.
He was a very funny man.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's wonderful. Oh, my God. I want to see that double feature now.
No, you know, thanks to the miracle of home video, you can program it yourself.
That's correct. That is correct. I wonder if they should do that on the Criterion Channel. You should run those together.
That's right. Along with my trailer.
That
got me in the business.
Trailer for both or just?
No, I didn't do the trailer for Cries and Whispers, but I did do the trailer for Cage TV.
That was your first?
It was my first trailer. Wow. It was an abomination.
The trailer?
I didn't know what I was doing. I was brought out here from New Jersey. I had never used a moviola. I was left in a room with a copy of the film and a moviola and told, make a trailer. And I put together the worst god-awful collection of, must have run 20 minutes of stuff, and I showed it to Roger. And in his usual way, he said, well, we can work with this. What he really said to me the first time I met him was, young man, if I were you, I'd try to get to these things on time.
But you made Jonathan Demme's career.
I don't. The picture did. The picture made money, and because of that, people said, "Well, the trailer must be good." And it's not. It's not a bad trailer, but
were flocking to.
It went way over
budget. To Cries and Whispers.
I didn't. Just, it didn't always play with Cries and Whispers. It's because Barbara Steele was in it.
That might be my favorite double feature. That's
pretty
amazing.
Good.
Wow. Give us another one, Julie. What do you?
This is my last one on the list.
Okay.
And of all of these, it's the last one I saw, even though it was made in 1966. So when I was at NYU as the chair of the graduate film department, people are always coming to me saying, you've seen such and such, of course. And then, of course, I'd scramble because I hadn't seen it. And the one film out of all of that that just blew me away and stays with me to this day is Black Girl.
I don't know it.
Well, it's by a Senegalese director. Was made in 1966, Ousmane Sembène, and it had to do with the effect of colonialism, but when the colonists left, and it's a story of a black girl who goes with a white French family when they move back to France from where they have been in Senegal, and for them it's kind of a lark to be there, and then how she's alienated by the combination of her employers who were upper middle class and of her being now in a place where there's a lot of discrimination against blacks, where she doesn't have her family, she has no friends, she has nothing but this all white house to take care of. Whereas she had been a nanny, but now the children are gone, I think, to boarding school. And ultimately, she commits suicide. But it's the way that he takes you on her journey, that you take on this girl's yoke and you take on her awareness of her surroundings and how it affects her and eventually devastates her. So that my last
ending question. On a high note.
Wow. Yeah, I need to look for that. Have you, it just occurs to me, you might, if you haven't seen it, I think you'd like, have you seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire this year?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's an amazing French film, Céline Sciamma, the director. It's late 18th century. Yeah, it's about a woman who's sent to paint the portrait of a daughter of wealth who doesn't want her portrait painted because it's going to be sent to the man she's never met, who, if he likes the portrait, will marry her.
Oh.
And it is, especially based on your list, I think you'd love it.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, it's brand new. If you guys get screeners, it's in your pile. yes.
We did not get a screener for Bombshell. I wonder why.
I would give you mine.
Well, no, we saw it. But,
you
know.
Well, sometimes you don't get
it. I got two.
I mean, are you in, you're in the Producers Guild?
No.
Oh, well, see, they send out screeners.
No. I'm in the producers section of the Academy.
Yeah, they send. And it's on the it's on their digital.
Oh, okay. Well, when I figure out how to use Apple TV, I'll get that.
Oh, okay. It's what they don't have the little water stamp on them.
The disclaimer.
If you watch them on the streaming channel,
Oh, really?
This is, yeah, our listeners love this. Screw you. We have seen him in a theater. But yeah, they don't, most of them at least don't have the For Your Consideration Only. So it's like watching a movie. Roger, what's next on yours?
Well, I have a couple of films that are entirely different, but there is one thing that connects the two, and you would not really connect these films. They would be Kurosawa's Rashomon and Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Peter!
What's the coroner got to say?
He's in a jar and puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
And what connects the two is that they both had a totally original take on a traditional kind of a story. Mm. Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street, having made a number of horror films myself, I felt these films are all beginning to look alike. People are running out of ideas. And his idea that a nightmare becomes reality and can kill you, I thought, Wes, all by himself, has reinvigorated the horror genre with a completely original and brilliant idea. Rashomon takes a killing and reinvigorates it by telling the story from the standpoint of different witnesses to the killing, and they all have a different interpretation as what took place. Now, Nightmare on Elm Street is, of course, a straight commercial film. Rashomon would be considered, I think by most people, one of the great art films. So I would have to lean a little heavily towards Rashomon. But it was brilliantly made. Wow. The actors were all excellent. And the fact that the actors could play different versions of the characters in different scenes. And Kurosawa was able to set up a slightly different use of the camera and editing in the different scenes. And also, people were not that much aware of Asian films. To my knowledge, it was the first Asian film, or at least one of the first, that got real recognition in the West. I think it got the grand prize at Cannes and might have gotten Best Foreign Film.
Right. Yeah. No. Definitely. At least serious ones. Am I? Yell at me if I'm wrong.
Gate of Hell, I think, was the laughter that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But think about it, you know, art film. It may be. It's entered the lexicon in a way that there are generations of people who use Rashomon as a reference point who probably don't even know where it comes from.
Yes.
Let alone that it's a film.
Well, maybe they've seen the remake, The Outrage.
Oh, right. That's right. Paul Newman, right?
With Paul Newman?
Yeah, yeah. I had forgotten.
Martin Ritt. It doesn't quite work.
I think it traumatized me.
It doesn't quite work. Yeah. But it's an interesting attempt.
Yeah, yeah. And Wes's movie it's interesting how you put that, because I remember seeing it and just thinking, yeah, there was just sort of something about it that was fresh and interesting and new. But
And it gave us a new movie monster, which is Freddy Krueger, who is essentially really the last horror actor. You know, after Vincent Price and Karloff and all everyone passed away, the whole idea of tailoring movies toward a particular kind of actor who could play those kind of parts kind of went away, except for Robert Englund, who managed to, I think, sort of coast on the leftovers of just saying, let's remake The Phantom of the Opera with Robert Englund.
Right.
Because we don't have anybody else who's known to be in that kind of film. And no one has ever risen to take their places.
It's true. Yeah, I'm trying to think of who's...
No, there isn't. I mean, they were thinking of remaking Theater of Blood, and in fact, they did a I think, a musical version of it on stage with Jim Broadbent. But they could never get a movie off the ground because there's nobody to play the part. I mean, Vincent Price brought with him so much history to that character that it really doesn't work with anybody else. And it's a wonderful film because of him.
I feel like Nicolas Cage could fill that slot.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, actually, that's a good idea. But I would then come to actually my last film that I would mention.
Oh, the one you were teasing.
Which I said the one I would keep. When Sight and Sound sent out that questionnaire to the various directors, I was the only one who chose as my favorite film of all time, The Battleship Potemkin.
Ah, okay.
And they wrote me and said, because I knew the people there, and they said, Roger, of all the directors, you're the only one who chose A Battleship Potemkin. Really? Would you write an article for us on The Battleship Potemkin? Which I did. But I think Potemkin was a pivotal picture in filmmaking. Eisenstein, I think it was made around 1920, give or take a year or two. We were still working with primitive techniques. Griffith had introduced the close-up, which changed filmmaking from just photographing like a stage play to cutting with people. But Eisenstein went a giant step further and introduced really a modern version of editing that is still used today. Yeah. His sequence, the Odessa Step sequence, where the troops march down the steps and they are killing people as they go. Yeah. And the cutting back and forth and the whole concept of the film about a failed mutiny, but you are with the mutineers, you know they are right, we know the Tsar's troops are wrong, was obviously made by an early communist regime. But I thought it dealt with the subject brilliantly, and I thought brought you back to, this is the way it was. This is, I said earlier about Ingmar Bergman's Seventh Seal. I think this is the way the Middle Ages were. I think this is the way the world existed at that time. Mm. And I just think it is a brilliant film from the acting, from the structure, from the photography, to the editing. I think it was the first modern film.
Yeah, it's funny, because that is the movie when I first saw I had the emotional reaction that I never had with Citizen Kane for some reason. On the Sight and Sound list, were you asked to name one film, or was it a list of?
We listed them all, but it listed you were them the by one, the one that
no
got
one
the best votes.
That.
I think, as usual, it was either Citizen Kane or Lawrence of Arabia. But down at the bottom, with one vote. Was Battleship Potemkin.
Good for you.
I would suggest the possibility of other reasons that Battleship Potemkin was your choice. One, you were in the Navy.
That's right.
So,
and I thought about mutiny every day.
You'd always been rebellious, and thinking back to our knowing each other before we worked together, before you called me when I was at the LA Times and said, "What can you find out in what was called the morgue then, which would be archives today, about the Hell's Angels?" Because I'm thinking of making a movie about them. And I called him back about 30 minutes later and said, "Don't have anything to do with them." So yes, your rebellious nature. I mean, you went straight forward even when, you know, Big Otto was threatening to snuff you out. But
I got along wonderfully with the Angels, except for the fact that they wanted to kill me.
Yeah.
That was a minor detail.
Yes.
But the other thing I would say is, as far as the structure of the film, you know, very clearly structured. I mean, there's bam, bam, bam. And the structure of the editing, I would think, would have appealed to your engineering background.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway,
very
I just
possibly.
Suggest all
yes,
of that.
I hadn't thought of that, but very possibly, because that was clearly very, very well thought out and planned.
Right.
There's a lot of work that's improvised, and I'm sure there was some improvisation in the picture, but it really looks as if this picture has been worked out shot by shot.
Well, I think also just with the size of the cameras and the bulkiness, she would have to have worked out everything down to the last degree in a way that you don't have to if you're shooting it all on an iPhone. So, Wow. Well,
but the current Sight and Sound leader is now Vertigo.
It's now Vertigo. Yeah. Yeah. Which is
which is interesting because it's a film that was roundly dismissed when it was new. And still has its detractors, but but nonetheless,
just raise my hand. For me, it's the only Hitchcock film that it's got no text. The subtext is the text, whereas kind of what you were saying about The Intruder, I like that to be I like to be brainwashed. I don't like to be lectured, I guess. And Vertigo just feels,
I think,
like
the reason it supplanted Citizen Kane is because they both have scores by Bernard Herrmann.
Yes. Do you share that assessment of Vertigo, the two of you? Or are you?
I don't get the hue and cry over Vertigo.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm all about the music, though.
Yeah. So. Oh, sure. No, it's lovely to look at, the color. And are you
No, I think Vertigo is very good, but I simply classify it as one of many very good films by Hitchcock.
Yeah. Yeah. And that sort of mystified me. Before we wrap up, I want to just tell a story. I'm sure you don't remember it, but I want to pat myself on the back a little bit using...
It's his podcast.
It's ours. We met, the privilege of being nominated for a Scripter Award for History of Violence, and you were at those awards. It was the first time I'd ever met you, and I introduced myself, and I had always wanted to tell you about this because there was no way you could possibly have known about this movie, but I had written and directed a little movie called Infested a few years earlier, it was a horror film. And I told you, and it was essentially I had taken The Big Chill and remade it as a horror film. And you said, "Oh, I wish I'd thought of that." And that was one of the greatest accolades I've ever gotten in my life. So
wait a minute. It's still a viable thought.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, go ahead. Do it right. No one's seen mine. I give it to you. Julie, Roger, thank you so very much for coming in and ushering in the 20s with us. On the movies that made me, it's been a real, real pleasure to talk to you and to walk through these films with you. So, thank you.
Thank you, Josh and Joe.
Thanks.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Look forward to other of your work.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year.
Yes.
Happy 2020.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. Official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for the Movies That Made Me.